I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with this worldwide news update. An ambush on a Syrian security patrol by gunmen loyal to ousted leader Bashar al-Assad escalated into clashes that have killed more than 1,000 people over 4 days, a war monitor estimates. The attack Thursday near the port city of Latakia reopened the wounds of the country's 13-year-old civil war and sparked the worst violence Syria has seen since December when insurgents overthrew Assad. The counteroffensive against the Assad loyalists in the largely Alawite coastal region brought havoc to several cities and towns. Israel has cut off the electricity supply to Gaza. The move has affected a desalination plant producing drinking water for part of the territory. The U.S.-designated terrorist group Hamas calls it part of Israel's starvation policy. Israel is pressing Hamas to accept an extension of the first phase of their ceasefire that ended last weekend. Hamas instead wants to start negotiations on the ceasefire's more difficult second phase. VOA's Arash Arbasadi has more.
In recent days, a Trump administration negotiator met with Hamas to discuss a hostage release deal, calling the meeting very helpful. In the meantime, for Palestinians in Gaza's Khan Yunis, shortages of basic needs continue. Israel imposed a total blockade on all goods entering the enclave, including food, fuel, and medicine, until Hamas frees the remaining 59 hostages still held in Gaza. People here say they wait for hours to get bread as there's no longer electricity or firewood for cooking. Israel says it plans to send a delegation to Qatar on Monday to advance negotiations with Egyptian and Qatari mediators. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News.
This is VOA News. Even as U.S.-led peace negotiations to end Russia's war in Ukraine recently faced setbacks, talks between Washington and Kyiv are set to take place this week in Saudi Arabia. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias has the details.
U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio traveled Sunday to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to hold talks with a Ukrainian delegation. The aim, according to an official statement, is to, quote, advance President Donald Trump's goal to end the Russia-Ukraine war. The visit comes days after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky sent President Trump a conciliatory letter in the aftermath of a contentious meeting the leaders had at the White House on February 28. As a form of pressure to get the parties to the negotiating table, Trump has paused military aid to Ukraine and intelligence sharing with Kyiv, while threatening to impose sanctions and tariffs on Russia. Veronica Valderas-Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
President Trump is dismissing business concerns over the uncertainty caused by his planned tariffs on American trading partners, AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
In an interview with Fox News' Sunday Morning Futures with Maria Bartiromo, Trump did not rule out the possibility of a recession this year.
I hate to predict things like that. There is a period of transition because what we're doing is very big. We're bringing wealth back to America. That's a big thing. And there are always periods of... It takes a little time.
He says his plans for broader reciprocal tariffs will go into effect April 2nd.
Big globalists have been ripping off the United States.
Last week, Trump imposed 25% tariffs on imports from Mexico and Canada and then quickly paused them. I'm Julie Walker.
Former central banker Mark Carney will become Canada's next prime minister after the governing Liberal Party elected him its leader on Sunday as the country deals with President Trump's trade war and annexation threat and a federal election looms. The 59-year-old Carney replaces Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who announced his resignation in January but remains prime minister until his successor is sworn in. Carney navigated crises when he was the head of the Bank of Canada, and in 2013 he became the first non-citizen to run the Bank of England since it was founded in 1694. Trudeau's popularity had declined as food and housing prices rose and immigration surged. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, March 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan reacts to a tribal advisory by the U.S. State Department.
Citizens can come to South Sudan. Their advice was not based on anything. There is nothing at all that can make them to issue such an advisory.
Nigeria rises to sixth place in a new Global Terrorism Index report. The Gambian diaspora is feeling betrayed and disenfranchised for being denied the right to vote. Malawi's opposition DPP says a proposed presidential age limit bill targets former President Mutharika and is unconstitutional.
The constitution of Malawi is very clear that everyone has got a right to participate in politics. There is no one that would put a limit on that right.
And the U.S. and Ukraine hold talks in Saudi Arabia on how to end the war with Russia. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan's information minister says all is well in his country and that a U.S. State Department tribal advisory issued on March 8 is not necessary. The advisory ordered the departure of non-emergency U.S. government employees from South Sudan last week due to continuous security threats. It said armed conflict is going on and it includes fighting between various political and ethnic groups. In addition, the advisory said cattle raids occur throughout the country and often lead to violence. Information Minister Michael McQuay tells me that President Salva Kiir has assured the country that South Sudan is not going back to war again.
This is uncalled for. Of course, they were frightened that there will be a reaction and people who have been orchestrating all the stories that there will be South Sudan is going back to war, people will fight and all these things. But that was their expectation, and nothing happened. So it was uncalled for. U.S. citizens can come to South Sudan. If they can advise U.S. citizens not to come, then what are they waiting for here? Their advice was not based on anything. There is nothing at all that can make them to issue such an advisory.
But last week, there were a lot of arrests and shooting. Doesn't that suggest some instability?
There was no shooting in Juba. There are arrests that have been conducted because those who are arrested here have been found to be the orchestrators of that incident which took place in Harper. There is no shooting in Juba.
Minister, there are those who are concerned that this incident can add to disturbing or delaying the peace process.
If the incident took place in Harper and it has nothing to do with Juba, that is one. Number two, it will not affect the peace agreement because it has nothing to do with the peace agreement.
But does it also impact the preparations for elections in South Sudan?
First of all, election is at the end of 2026, not tomorrow. End of 2026 is the election. That is almost 2 years from now. How can you say, as of now, that thing will affect the elections later?
The United Nations representative in South Sudan, just I think 2 weeks ago, expressed concern or called on your government to begin preparations for the elections.
That is what they think. People are already in the process, but we cannot say now we are now going for elections because this election will be at the end of in December 2026, not in December 2025. So there is still enough time for people to prepare and go for elections. All that they could have been saying, instead they should have said expedite the process, the constitutional making process, so that the permanent constitution comes out in time, expedite the security arrangements so that all the forces are trained and unified. This is what they should be talking about.
So, Minister, is it the view of your government that last week's events do not have any impact on the peace process?
Did you hear the statement of a president where he assured the people of South Sudan that there is no going back to war, that I will not take you back to war? If he is assuring the people, it means that all these will not affect the election, and we are going ahead with the implementation of the agreement.
So before I let you go, Minister, the people who were arrested as a result of last week's event, have they been...
Are arrested will be charged because there is sufficient evidence against them that will warrant their being charged and taken to the court. There is no way whereby people who begin to conspire against the government and then they are arrested and released. No. So the agreement does not give them the authority to sabotage and begin to work against the very government in which they are members.
Michael Makui is South Sudan's information minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Juba. A spokesperson for former Malawi President Alpha Peter Mutharika says a proposed presidential age limit bill would be unconstitutional. It would limit anyone older than 80 years of age from running for president. Malawi will hold presidential and parliamentary election in September, and 85-year-old former President Mutharika is the likely candidate for the opposition Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP. Shadrick Namalomba is the spokesperson for former President Mutharika. He tells me that Malawi's constitution guarantees every citizen the right to participate in elections irrespective of age. In addition, he says, wisdom comes with age.
On the onset, there is no proposed bill at the moment. What is being obtained in public is a petition that some grouping wanted to present in parliament. But apparently the leader of that organization went into self-abduction. That said, even that petition and even the bill that would come from that petition would be unconstitutional and illegal. The constitution of Malawi is very clear that everyone has got a right to participate in politics. There is no one that would put a limit on that right. In any case, for such a bill to be given the effect at law, it must go through the constitution. So you must begin by amending the constitution of Malawi. And to amend the constitution of Malawi is a tall order because it requires two-thirds of the members in parliament. So we believe that these are tactics, gimmicks, propaganda aimed at making sure that the people should lose their trust, because they want Professor Kabila Mutharika. They should lose that trust and then maybe not even go and vote.
Don't you think there's a need for an age limit for a position like the presidency?
Why should we have an age limit? Do we have an age limit even in the United States? Do we have an age limit even in the Great Britain? We don't have an age limit on the president. And in any case, the elderly have also got a right to participate in democracy.
So the argument is that the older you get, especially for a position like the presidency, is very demanding. That's why I think the proponents are saying perhaps we need to have an age limit so that whoever is there can be able to manage all the problems that come with the presidency.
I do not want to mention specifically individuals that have become president in their advanced years. I don't want to do that. It may not be diplomatic. But I'll just say we have presidents who are advanced in years, even in the United States. We have seen presidents there who are advanced. Should we say that they failed to deliver because of age? No, they did not. Even Nelson Mandela, at what age did Nelson Mandela become president of South Africa? Is he not one of the best presidents in Africa? He is. So even if we were going to go medically, scientifically, has it been proven that when you are aged, then you stop thinking, then you cannot attend to the demands of an office of the nature of presidency? No. Even as we live socially, it has never been proven.
Shadrick Namalomba is the spokesperson for former Malawi President Alpha Peter Mutharika. He was speaking with us from Blantyre. A global index report on terrorism shows that Nigeria has risen to sixth place in global terrorism, with dozens killed in 2024. This comes as the Nigerian Human Rights Commission says human rights violations in the country rose to 25% in February. Mohamed Sanu Abubakar is a researcher with the Department of Military Studies with the Abuja Leadership Center at the University of Abuja. He tells viewers Jinedu Ofor that the report is a wake-up call for the government to do more in fighting jihadist groups.
Global Terrorism Index is being carried out by the Institute of Economics and Peace. It's a credible organization. They are a reliable body.
Listing Nigeria where it is at the moment, do you think that's a fair assessment of the efforts of the Nigerian government in tackling terrorism?
I concur. It's a fair assessment of the Nigerian government in terms of combating terrorism and other security challenges. Although I have read somewhere where I think Major General Kenge, the new spokesman of the defense headquarters, is saying they don't really want to accept the assessment. I want to say it's a fair assessment of the Nigerian government. Nigerian government have been accepting the results whenever it's favorable to the government. So I see no reason why a person or an institution would now say they don't want to accept the result because they think the assessment is not fair.
What are the key instances under which this assessment was made when it concerns the Nigerian government efforts to root out terrorism?
I think, number one, they made this assessment based on the number of attacks carried out by Boko Haram as well as ISWA in the country. Then number two, fatalities recorded, people injured during those attacks. As I've said, I think these were the three major criteria they looked at. Now, if attacks were carried out by Boko Haram or ISWA, some people died, maybe civilians or combatants, the military, it means the government forces have lapses because they couldn't repel those attacks, stop the attack, prevent the attacks. So it's on those criteria. Otherwise, there will be no way attacks will be launched by Boko Haram or ISWAP. And instead of repelling them now, you allow them to scale through. And we're hearing about 100 plus deaths in Yobe, in Termua, deaths again in parts of Borno, and some other places, number of attacks increasing to 22% or so. These are some of the criteria they use to make those assessments. I believe it's a peer assessment because I'm not sure if they are factoring what is even happening in the Northwest.
What is happening in the Northwest?
It has to do with frequent attacks by bandits and criminal gangs. They kidnap persons and they ransack entire villages because of maybe minerals and livestock and stuff like that.
The Nigerian government says it's doing as much as it can and spending more resources in training and purchasing military equipment. What areas do you think they need to do more?
Nigerian government need to sit down and re-strategize. This issue of bad governance, weak governance, whatever way you want to call it.
That's Mohammed Sanu Abubakar, the Research Department of Military Studies with the Abuja Leadership Center at the University of Abuja. He was speaking with viewers Chinedu Ofor from the northern city of Maiduguri. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, March 10th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Still to come on our program, Samson Omale Sports. A Gambian activist said the country's diaspora is feeling betrayed and disenfranchised by President Adama Barrow and the ruling National People's Party. This after the parliament defeated a bill that would have granted Gambians living abroad the right to vote in this year's general elections. Justice Minister Dauda Diallo was quoted in the local media as saying that the voting rights bill was rejected because of logistical and legal hurdles, such as the absence of diaspora constituency in the electoral framework. Paz Samba Jao is a Gambian activist and co-host of the podcast For the People, By the People. He tells me there has been a lack of political will by successive governments to guarantee voting rights for the Gambian diaspora.
We all know that Gambia has a large population of people in the diaspora. In fact, according to the last estimates, there are over 200,000 Gambians who live in the diaspora and very, very active in the affairs of our country. And every year, just this last year, Gambians sent over $700 million as remittances to that country. We contributed to almost about 32% GDP. But for a very long time, Gambians have been denied, Gambians in the diaspora, the right to enfranchisement. Because Section 39 of our Constitution gives every Gambian that is 18 years of age, at least, and of sound mind, the right to be registered to vote. So this is what we've been asking for.
Gambians living in the diaspora have not voted before, have you?
No, we have never voted before, even though the Constitution is very clear about that. Even though the Elections Act is very clear about it. So it has always been the lack of political will by the leadership to ensure that we voted. But the disappointing thing about this, with the diaspora seen as a big betrayal, is that Adama Barrow, whose presidency was as a result of the diaspora putting wealth and everything possible to make it happen, and who campaigned with his partners on some of these things, diaspora voting, electoral reforms and everything, is now the one standing in the way of the diaspora who made his presidency possible.
What do you make of the argument by the Gambian Justice Minister that this is because of the lack of the absence of diaspora constituencies in the electoral framework? That's his argument.
Well, that argument is flawed, and this is why. 2 years ago, myself, Pastor Mbajau, His Excellency Bibi Dabo, who used to be a vice president, Mr. Sidi Sane, Mr. Charmanjai, and Mr. Jagan Gray Johnson, took this matter to the Supreme Court of the Gambia to reaffirm our right to vote as a diaspora. And the Supreme Court came with a ruling siding with us that, yes, every Gambian, including those in the diaspora, have a right to vote. So the argument by the Justice Minister is lame and flawed, because that would have only been a possibility where they would have to demarcate the diaspora as a constituency. That was if we were to vote in the National Assembly. But when it comes to the presidency, all they need to do is register people based on constituencies that they came from. Every Gambian came from a constituency. So to me, that was not only disappointing, but a very lame argument that was meant for nothing but to cover the sinister effort by this government to ensure that those in the diaspora will not vote.
If you said that the Gambian president even supported the idea of the diaspora voting, what do you make of the fact that it was the ruling party members of parliament who contributed to the defeat of the bill?
That's why I characterize it as a betrayal. Because when Adama Barrow was campaigning, part of their agenda, the coalition, it was Go For Them, Gambia Opposition for Electoral Reform. That was the name. When they came and formed coalition 2016, part of their argument included total electoral reform that would also ensure the enfranchisement of the diaspora. In fact, interestingly, 25 years ago, Ali Vassallah, who was the spokesperson of Adama Barrow, had written then to the then chairman of the IEC and the government to ensure that the diaspora was fully enfranchised. So definitely everybody in the opposition then, including Adama Barrow, was in line with the diaspora's enfranchisement. But like he did with the three-year agreement, like he did with only running staying in power for one term, President Adama Barrow reneged on that promise.
Pastor Majaro is a Gambian activist and the co-host of the podcast For the People, By the People. He was speaking with me from the U.S. state of Maryland. The United Nations says fighting between M23 rebels and pro-Congo militias was underway on Sunday in Nyambiodo, about 100 kilometers north of Goma in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Residents said days after a nearby attack left heavy civilian death toll. Reuters reports that the M23 rebel group has seized the swaths of mineral-rich Eastern Congo since the start of the year. Even as U.S.-led peace negotiations to end Russia's war in Ukraine recently faced a setback, talks between Washington and Kiev are set to take place this week in Saudi Arabia. Viewer's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has the details.
To promote peace around
U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio traveled Sunday to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to hold talks with a Ukrainian delegation. The aim, according to an official statement, is to, quote, advance President Donald Trump's goal to end the Russia-Ukraine war. The visit comes days after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky sent President Trump a conciliatory letter in the aftermath of a contentious meeting the leaders had at the White House on February 28. Trump commented Friday on the status of the peace negotiations.
I think we're doing very well with Russia. But right now they're bombing the hell out of Ukraine. And Ukraine, I'm finding it more difficult, frankly, to deal with Ukraine. And they don't have the cards.
As a form of pressure to get the parties to the negotiating table, Trump has paused military aid to Ukraine and intelligence sharing with Kyiv, while threatening to impose sanctions and tariffs on Russia. Securing a deal is important for Trump politically, analysts note. William Pomerantz is a senior scholar at the Cannon Institute. He was interviewed via Zoom.
He has bet, essentially, his presidency that some sort of deal will be obtained. And I don't know, there's so many moving players during these negotiations, whether it's Russia, Ukraine, the EU.
Stand with Ukraine.
In the lead up to the U.S.-Ukrainian talks in Jeddah, which are expected to last until March 12, supporters of Ukraine rallied Saturday in Washington, while Ukrainian officials denounced a series of Russian attacks over the weekend against Ukrainian targets in Donetsk, among other regions. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa's Pulse, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with women football. The journey to the FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup resumed this past weekend as Nigeria secured a convincing 3-1 away win from home against South Africa. In the East African Derby, Kenya pulled off an impressive 2-0 victory over Uganda on their home turf. Cameroon were clinical in front of goal as the Crews passed Ethiopia 5-2. Elsewhere, Guinea and Sierra Leone played a 2-2 draw to set up what promises to be another exciting duel in the return leg between the two sides. Algeria stunned Botswana 2-1. Still with football news, football legend Samuel Eto'o has won a major legal victory, overturning a ban that blocked his bid for a position on Africa's football governing body, CAF. The Court of Arbitration for Sport ruled in Eto'o's favour after he appealed CAF's decision to exclude him from its executive committee. The 43-year-old has been president of the Cameroonian Football Federation since 2021. However, his leadership has been controversial. In September, FIFA banned him for 6 months over misconduct, and CAF fined him $200,000 last year for violating ethics by promoting a betting company. Eto'o's legal team successfully appealed the fine in February. In athletics, Kenya's Sheila Chepkirui clocked 2 hours, 20 minutes, 40 seconds to win the Nagoya Women's Marathon, a World Athletics Platinum Libero race. On Sunday, the New York City Marathon champion finished 19 seconds ahead of Japan's Sayaka Sato, whose 2 hours, 20 minutes, 59 seconds was a personal best by more than a minute, while Bahrain's Eunice Chumba was third in 2 hours, 21 minutes, 35 seconds. The race represented a final opportunity for Japanese women to try to secure a place on the host nation team for the World Athletics Championships Tokyo 2025. Staying with athletics, Ethiopia's legendary athlete Haile Gebrselassie will be in Kenya next month to sign a memorandum of understanding with the organizers of the Eldoret City Marathon. The move is to strengthen such races in the East African region. The sixth edition of the Eldoret City Marathon will be held on the 27th of April in Eldoret. And now to cycling, where South Africa's Tyler Lange won the men's elite Cape Town Cycle Tour in perfect conditions on Sunday. Lange crossed the line in a time of 2 hours, 25 minutes, 47 seconds. His compatriot, Reindert Jens van Rensburg, took second place in the same time, with another local rider, Jordan Talou, rounding out the podium a second adrift. The men's elite race covered 109 kilometers. And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa's Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, March 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM stations.